Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos.
Hey, everybody. My name is Amanda Nduka, and oh my gosh, guess who we have?
Who do we have, guys? Guess. We'll give you a moment.
You can probably read it, but
that's right. They could read it on the title. So
Regina King for today's episode. Director of One Night in Miami, that is getting yes. a lot of buzz.
Yes, and can we say Emmy Award winner, Oscar winner, Brenda from 227.
She can do, like, you guys, this lady can do it all. Like, we've seen her go from Brenda Evan to starring in The Watchmen, which
yes.
was amazing.
Which is a far cry from what Brenda was. And I honestly think that she is probably, even though she does have an Oscar and an Emmy, I still think she's an underrated actress. Honestly, if I'm going to be 100%.
Yeah, she definitely deserves to be up there. Like, I think she's like Meryl Streep, but like, all, like, she's definitely on that level. I mean, I she was basically... all the movies that I watched in the 90s, she was in them. She was so critical to that era of cinema, Black cinema.
And I think her just her ability to change, you know, we saw her in Boys in the Hood and Poetic Justice, but then to have her totally do this 180 and then us seeing her in like Jerry Maguire and then like, you know, being in shows like Southland and then, and then directing One Night in Miami, which is such a kind of, it's a powerful film and it's an interesting film that explores identity, specifically Black identity.
And we talk about that. I mean, we talk about a lot. I mean, this was a very, very fun podcast to do. But Regina, she's just a gem. She went from directing TV. Now she's directing film. She directed this amazing film about these four Black men. It was like, we talk about it and, you know, she wanted to do something Titanic, romantic in a sense.
Yes.
And this is sort of, in a way, has its sort of romantic element, but obviously kind of spun in a different way. So if you haven't seen it, it's on Amazon. So I'm sure everybody in this planet has Amazon.
Yeah. And also, you know, if you haven't seen it by now, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing listening to this podcast? If you haven't seen it, turn this off, go watch it and come back.
Yes. And so without further ado, here is Regina. Regina King, welcome to Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. We are, I don't even know if excited is the word to describe
what we're ecstatic? Thank you so much.
Yeah, we're so happy that you joined us today. How are you doing?
Honestly?
Yes.
Yes, be honest. We're here for the honesty.
Right, okay. I am tired. But I'm sure that that's a sentiment that most of us resemble about now.
Yeah.
But when I say tired, I'm physically tired. But I think we're all in a mental space where we are exhausted.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Have you been doing a lot? So how is doing, like, so you've been doing this award circuit for a while now. How is it now, like, during the quarantine and in this new sort of era?
Honestly,
we're here for
that. Love it.
It's interesting. I'm a person that really likes the real interaction with mm-hmm. people, and to have this be my theatrical directing debut, it's been a little tough not having the opportunity to attend screenings and right. actually be able to, you know, talk to people in person and you know, do the whole thing that a lot of artists do that are in the film industry. You know, you sneak into a theater and kind of right. sit in the back of the theater to see how the audience is receiving, you know, something that you've done. I haven't been able to have that shared experience mm. that a movie theater brings. So that's been kind of tough. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Q&As seem to have tripled this I think because, you know, they're
easier.
Like, well, yeah, you're home. Right, so right. we can fit one more in, right. you know.
It's still just as exhausting though. Like,
no, yeah. I mean, it's like, I'm not gonna lie. I think a lot of us have Zoom fatigue.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, as much as lovely as it is to see you on screen, you know, I think me and Amanda, even our producer David, we just love being in the studio and recording yeah. and yeah. just kind of, because there's a chemistry or just like a feeling that you don't yeah. get through screens.
You yeah. just don't, yeah. and you never will, you know, right. even mm-hmm. when you talk about with film, films now everything is shot digitally
right.
and we've all witnessed how far the cameras have come and how they've almost been able to truly duplicate the quality of film
right.
And so there are some artists that will still argue that no, you can't do that, and in some cases I agree. I do feel like when you're using certain film lenses on the digital cameras, you do tend to get that film quality more. But this is not something that we will be able to replace. These right. Zoom calls will never yeah. be able to replace a hug.
Right.
You'll never yeah. be able to replace looking in someone's eyes.
Right.
You could still do these Zoom meetings or calls or appearances. And that's what they are really, appearances. You know, when we finally meet each other in real life, it'll be like, oh my God, I didn't know your eyes were like the color of agony, you know? Because it doesn't translate.
A reintroduction sort of thing.
Yeah, it is.
So before we jump into, like you mentioned, your directorial debut, One Night in Miami, which congratulations yes. on that film. We'll get to that in a second. But first I want to ask you, we just like to get here on this podcast, we like to talk about everybody's journeys because everybody has a very unique interest.
Uh-oh. Amanda.
One of the other benefits of Zoom life.
Wanted to be yeah. a performer.
Oh, wait,
oh
Amanda,
man, was I frozen?
Yeah, you were frozen. So just ask the question again. Yeah.
Okay. So I was asking, when was your first time that you remember feeling that you wanted to be a performer or and a creator?
That is tough because, you know, I've been doing this for quite some time. I've been doing this more years than I haven't been doing it.
Mm.
So that's a blessing.
Mm.
But I feel like it's one of those things that it just subconsciously was always there because my sister and I were always, Raina and I were always putting on our home productions for just ourselves. and then our parents, and sometimes family members. So I guess the affinity for it was always there. But I will say that sometime maybe in my second year of college is when I was like, yeah, you know what? I think the acting thing needs to be my career. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do this college thing. I think I want to totally devote myself to that, because I think when I was doing 227 as a teenager, I was still wanting to be a dentist, you know.
I read that you almost quit to become a dentist.
Yeah, I really had kind of like a unique experience where most kids don't have this experience. I love my pediatric dentist, Dr. Rubel. And his dental assistant was his wife. Her name was Babe. And I actually look forward to going to the dentist because he made the experience so fun. And being the type of kid that likes to get gold stars and likes to get the pat on the back because you've done a good job, you know, it encouraged me to want to brush my teeth. And, you know, I probably was like the only like 9-year-old flossing. just because he just created that experience that one helped me understand how important, you know, your teeth are and dental care, like how that can affect the rest of your body if you're not taking care of your teeth. Let me move out of this sun. And I move more into the sun.
It looks nice. The lighting's very nice. Okay.
I think that experience is what led me to really start paying attention to people's smiles and mm-hmm. how you talk about eyes or the windows of the soul, or eyes are the first thing you notice on people. People's smiles were like the first thing that I'd noticed. So I don't know why that came up, but.
Because of dentistry.
And that's where I thought my career path was going to be. And I did not realize that how much joy I was getting and would get with my sister, us pretending to be so many different people, you know? And I enjoy the exploration of different characters. I really love watching people and applying those things.
Who were the people that you kind of watched and maybe emulated when you were doing your shows?
Oh my gosh, shows meaning my sister
And what productions were you doing? What kind of reenactments were you doing?
There used to be, neither one of you remember this, but there was this show on TV called Alice. We would, in our backyard, take little things in our backyard and turn it into like a kitchen. And there were like these little stones that my mom had that she made into like a walkway that we would pull them up and use them as plates because they were like flat stones. So basically it would be everyone from the cast of Alice to my mother's friend, Tommy, who had to put on lipstick and put a piece of gum in her mouth every time she was smoking a cigarette. So it was just paying attention to details, people's characteristics, personality characteristics that, you know, define them. And that was just always so interesting to Raina and I. And it never stopped. We always loved it. Even as grown-up kids, we'll sometimes, since we're part of the same bubble, we'll still to this day, you know, have lunch in the car to just sit and people watch.
I love me a good session of people watching.
Oh, yes.
And then when you make them have conversations with each other.
Yeah. It's always what's she saying? What's she saying? Yeah. She is hot mad right now.
Or when we used to be able to go to like restaurants, I would always be with my friends and we see a couple and be all, are they on their first date? You think they're married? Yes. What's their story? Yes.
Number one question is, do you think they're married?
Yes. Yes.
And just because they have a wedding ring on doesn't mean they're married to
right.
you.
But I always also, there would be times and like it would be clear they were in a fight. And we would always like listen. I love watching people fight. I'm messy.
Especially people that are fighting, that are trying not to let the world in on the fight. And that is, those are the most fascinating people watching sessions, because it's watching the behavioral changes that, mm-hmm. you know, from eating a certain way to eating.
You know, yeah, you're
right. And I imagine that really helps with acting, right? Like just the whole people. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the reason why I am an actor, because I'm taking snapshots all the time of mm-hmm. the way people talk, the way people move, and finding ways to apply those snapshots to characters.
Mm, yeah. You mentioned 227, which, you know,
iconic.
But you've also appeared in things like Boys in the Hood, Poetic Justice, Friday, all these films that were so integral to 90s.
Well, you're part of our childhood, all my teenage years. You know, yeah.
You're just talking about that era that really shaped a lot of us, and a lot of us like call back to, you know, all these films that we watch that are classics. But when you were sort of starting out and sort of navigating your way through this crazy business, how did you approach sort of what Hollywood expected from you as an actor versus where you wanted to go in your career as an artist?
I think I was, because I started so young, I don't think I was ever approaching it as what Hollywood is expecting. Mm. It was more like what Gloria was expecting, my mom, mm. you know, and just my sister and I never wanted to disappoint our parents, you know, mm. like it was, and I think a lot of children feel that way, you know, especially if you're lucky enough to have a close relationship with, you know, your parents. You don't want to disappoint, but, you know, good manners was always an important thing. So my mother didn't stop working when I was on 227. My sister was also on a show called What's Happening Now, and we were on the shows at the same time. So my mother had two family friends who weren't working be our chaperone, if you will, a guardian while we were on the set, so she could continue working. And, you know, it was more like, you know, don't act up, you know, while. So it was that and also her always encouraging us to, you know, when I'm talking about observation, that's something that also came from our mother too. She's a teacher. So always encouraging us to take all we can out of a moment, you know, always, finding all of the little jewels and all of the pitfalls that are happening while you're there, to take a moment after it's happened and, you know, process like, okay, what can you do better? How can you be the better Regina Arena? Mm-hmm. There was this book that she had given us called, I think it was called The Big Me, The Little Me, and The Greater Me. Mm-hmm. And what the theme of the book was, you know, how we choose which me is going to show up. And so I think it was more me, the world according to Gloria, mm-hmm. which now as an adult, I'm so grateful for, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And was there a point, I know we listen to, we hear all these, especially when it comes to women of color in the industry, we hear sort of the struggles that they go through in the early stages of the career. I mean, obviously, we're all aware of Hollywood's treatment when it comes to women of color, when it comes to people of color, period. People, like I said, in those marginalized, in that marginalized group. But is there a point in your career, or at what point in your career, because you are Miss Regina King now, at what point of your career did you feel a shift in terms of having more control over what you wanted to do?
Probably later in my career, you know. I guess there were moments in different places in my career. I would say probably the first one was when I kind of mentioned not too long ago when I was in college and decided that I was going to drop out, even though my mother was, I knew she wasn't going to be happy about that, because I wanted to truly pursue acting as a career. And I wanted people not to look at me as Brenda from 227. I had been studying acting for quite some time prior to 227, all while I was on 227. And to that point, the only thing the world had seen me in is Brenda's 227 on 227. No one had seen plays that I had done, or people had seen them, but you know, LA, just a small theater in LA. And so the desire to not feel so much like, what is my mother or my grandmother gonna think about this, knowing that they aren't going to probably love the idea that I'm dropping out, but my mother had always been so supportive. So I guess I felt like it's gonna be okay, but deciding that I'm gonna do it and I'm gonna go audition for like Boys in the Hood.
Yeah.
And that could not have been more of a 180 from Brenda. So I guess that was like the first moment that that happened.
Yeah. Singleton, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. Oh God. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, you know, we could talk, I could talk about Boys in the Hood, Poetic Justice forever. I mean, for real, that was a moment, that was an era. And I, like I said before, I think kind of you had this like very storied career ending, like going from like that to Jerry Maguire and then to more recently like Watchmen, which I could also talk about forever, but we won't. but also you stepped behind the camera before One Night in Miami for series. You know, we have, you know, you directed like episode of Southland, Scandal, This Is Us, Shameless, The Good Doctor, Insecure. I'm reading your IMDb right now. but you know, I feel that like a lot of actors like make that kind of is like an organic shift for going from acting to directing. But when you did that shift to TV and then now film, what were the assumptions you had about directing? And then what were some kind of the challenges and habits you had to kind of break or get used to even? And when did you like finding a rhythm in your directing voice?
Right. Well, I had been directing, I mean, I had been acting in films for a nice big chunk of, you know, my life. Like I started in 227 and then I think maybe for 10 or 15 years, all I was doing were films after 227. So I definitely, at that point, was able, just from an actor's perspective, to see the difference between the way television and then sitcom television, multicam television, to films was a huge difference, just how that a whole process would go. But along the way, I was storing all of this knowledge, all of these jewels, regardless if I was consciously aware of all that was being poured into me. It wasn't until somewhere along the lines of maybe 24 when I started saying out loud to my sister that I wanted to direct. But at that time, my son was really young, and I'd made the decision prior to 20, how I ended up on 24 was I didn't want to take any jobs outside of LA anymore. And so that's how the film, acting in films slowed down, because television was going to afford me the opportunity to still make money mm-hmm. and to stay in LA. Mm-hmm. And so that happened. And then that was really like my first, like I had done like guest appearances on like this show called called Northern Exposure.
Yeah.
And what else? New York Undercover. So those were my only two episodic experiences as an actor. The real experience on episodic came with 24. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a whole nother kind of world. Like, oh, okay, my experience had only been sitcom and then film. And now this thing called episodic TV. Sure, I watched it and have loved it all my life, but I'd never have been a part of it like this mm-hmm. and understanding how the writer room works. Mm-hmm. And so around there, I feel like I started really taking in on a deeper level what everyone is doing behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And it just continued on from there.
Yeah. It is like to see you kind of, you as an artist go from something, you know, we would sit at home watching 227 and then, you know, I loved it, obviously. There's no place like home. and then like, I think what I loved about what your career route is like, you surprised us at every turn. Like when I saw you on Jerry Maguire, I was like, what is Brenda doing there? And then you do stuff like Southland or especially Watchmen. I was just like, Regina's giving the girls everything they want. So I was like, but now with you as director, I remember when the news broke about you directing One Night Miami, Mike, you know, called me and I was on my way to a meeting at Disney because we were talking about like the you breaking the news. And then I pulled over on the side of the road to write the story.
Oh
my. and I was like, oh, now here we are. And it's one of the most critically acclaimed films, you know, one of my faves of the year. By the way, it's better. I mean, it was good. When I watched it the first time, I was like, oh, that was good. I watched it the second time and I was like, ooh, that's really good. That's better with each viewing. Right? You catch things that you don't, that I didn't catch the first time around, because you know when you've watched the movie first time, you're just like all experience. Then I start to dissect. But anyways,
right. That's wonderful for me because I feel like that's kind of like a common sentiment that we've all been getting about this film. And so there's something just really special that. People want to go back and watch it again, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a really great thing. That's,
and it's, and it's, I think also it's just gorgeous to look at. And, you know, we're not going to lie. The cast is easy on the eyes. we had Kingsley on our podcast.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That Kingsley, man, look out for him.
Yes. We were talking, we've seen him so many things in 2020. I'm like, I saw you like five different different projects. Like,
and he's quite the chameleon.
Yeah.
He is. And we learned that he loves rave music, which was very fun to find out the house and rave music.
I think that, but especially now learning that, because it's like, Malcolm X likes
Make sure Malcolm X raving
I'm
out.
Like, yeah. What, Malcolm X with glow sticks? Okay. Right. But you know, One Night in Miami, I think it feels like a big order, like that's tall order. Why did you pick this as like, I mean, I'm sure even before this, people were throwing opportunities your way, but why this movie? And you know, why do you think now's the time for you?
Well, I mean, contrary to popular belief, people weren't throwing things.
Okay.
but I have a really awesome team in my agents, And I started working with a lit agent at the agency I'd been with for 20, that I've been with for 20 years. And he took me to breakfast and asked me, you know, the reason why I met with him, I have okay, I'll break it down. Just so that it all makes sense. So you have, when you're producing and directing and acting, and say if you're a person that's doing live shows, you probably have several different agents that are servicing each faction, you know? So there, I have a lit agent that only deals with the television directing I'm doing, and then one that only deals with the film directing, and then one agent that only deals with the packaging, and so far, so on and so on. So I said, you know, I really want to, I want to direct a film. My talent agents, who I've been with the longest, they knew that the television directing that I was doing was in preparation to eventually direct a film. Mm. And so when I sat down with Harley and he asked me, you know, well, what type of stories do you want to tell as a filmmaker? You know, that's, you know, and it doesn't have to be one type of story. What? And he was looking at me the way my talent agents and the way my television directing lit agent was looking at me, that not in a box, that I could, that it, the things that I do aren't just because I'm Black or just because I'm a woman, it's because I'm an artist. And so we immediately connected with that. And when I shared with him that I wanted to tell a story that was a love story for Black people, that was like our Titanic, where it's has a historical story, that is kind of the B story, with our love story being the A story. And we all love the Titanic. Well, at least most, I don't think I really met anybody that was like, Titanic.
Well, there was room on that door for
Ow. Oh my God.
That's gonna be forever an argument till the end of time.
Like, why did he have to die? Like,
right, she was hogging that whole door.
I mean, girl. but you know, I wanted to tell a story like that, and you know, he took that back, and you know, came back and shared one night in Miami and a couple of other scripts that spoke to the other types of films that I said I was interested in. Stories and telling. And one night in Miami, while it wasn't the typical romance, it was definitely a love letter to Black men. There is love all throughout that. And Kemp Powers, that wrote the script, he adapted his own play into a screenplay. The dialogue was just truly the star, and it really represented for me the conversations that I have as an artist, being a Black artist, and where our art meets our social responsibility. And then it also, in my opinion, reflected conversations that I know the Black men that I love in my life are having or have had. I felt like I saw my son in this story. You know, I saw members of my family in these men. And yet they're four of the most iconic men in, you know, American history. So all of those, and it was an actor's piece.
Yeah.
It truly was just an opportunity that for an actor to just get lost in. Yeah. And the four actors, Kingsley, Leslie, Aldis, and Eli, did exactly that.
Yeah. I want to talk about the timeliness of this film, because it's you know, obviously takes place in the 60s, but there's so many different relevant themes that we can sort of attribute to the conversation that we're having today. One in particular that stands out is sort of this duality that you present with Malcolm and with Sam, Sam's character, and how, you know, Malcolm, in Malcolm's head, Sam is being a sellout because he's, you know, he's appeasing the white man, but in Sam's head, he's seen as somebody to look up to, because he's become, you know, this independent, successful guy doing what he's doing. So he sees himself as this sort of idol. And I see these conversations sort of happening today about, you know, especially when it comes to Black men and what it means to be a Black man, and how it is to be a Black man. And I just want to ask you, why was that so important for you guys to kind of showcase and highlight?
I think because, as you pointed out, it's a debate, it's a conversation that has been happening, you know, ever since the beginning of Black artists, probably the Harlem Renaissance, you know, these conversations have been happening. And I felt like it was important, or the filmmakers, we all felt like it was important to show that, both styles of accomplishing advancement or equality, mm-hmm. For Black people are necessary to actually achieve it. They're neither one of them are wrong, and it is one of the beautiful things is that by the end of the film, it was my intention to have a coda that felt like Malcolm and Sam both saw each other. Mm-hmm. That they both understood that they're both needed and necessary in the struggle. Mm-hmm. They're situational. Right, depending on the situation is depending on how, if you got to work from inside out like Sam or like Malcolm, let's just blow this whole thing up. Start all over, you know.
I think that's like, I think for the Black community or for any marginalized person, I think we have that argument in our head all the time, right?
Well, today we do.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we're arguing, there's people that are, you know, arguing for, you know, there's no other way to do this other than this one way. And, you know, there are people that are saying that, no, you know, violent, you know, this is not the answer. So we're still having these very important conversations, and it's so nuanced, but what you said is correct. It's like, we need both, you know, like mm-hmm. we need to have both sort of ideologies, I think, in order to lift up the people as a whole. And we need not just those two, but, you know, the different sort of nuanced thoughts that we have about how to like uplift our people and stuff. I think that was really interesting, and that you guys kind of set up those two and had those conversations between those two.
And it's for people to leave this this couple of hours of watching this story and to leave encouraged to think about what that means for themselves as an individual, for yourself as an individual. I think one of the most unfair things that we can do as a celebrity is tell another celebrity what you should be doing with your platform. It's very dangerous to me.
I think that's so interesting you say that, you know, about like people who are on the front, like kind of have a face or they have a huge platform, and whether you're in the Black community, like for instance, I'm going to speak, you know, this violence against the Asian community right now. I have opinions about it. I've been like in clubhouse rooms and all that, but then there's this burden of like, oh, if you don't talk about it, then you don't care. Or,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And do you ever feel like sometimes you have to be so careful when you do talk about it?
That's why I honestly sometimes, that's why I choose to hold back most of the time.
Exactly.
I don't know if the way I'm feeling is going to offend somebody, or I'm going to say the wrong thing. You know, you just never know. And how does anybody feel safe expressing themselves these days? You know,
and because in all actuality, the way you feel on Tuesday may not be the way you feel on Thursday.
Exactly.
And it's such a nuanced conversation with treatment of people, you know, like how we treat our community, because it also shows that we're not a monolith and all that. And it's a hard conversation, but also I think I've been seeing across the Asian community that it's kind of like realizing also the Asian community is so siloed that I think it's probably the same for the Black community and the Latino community. It's like, I was in a Clubhouse room and I said, I don't know if this was controversial. I was just like, I think the Asian community needs to get their shit together first before they tackle something bigger.
but that was
kind of me being a little bit tongue in cheek, but
actually, you know, that's the thing when I say, you know, how you feel about a Tuesday is different than how you feel about a Thursday, but all of them are how you feel about it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's fair. I think one of the, again, most dangerous things that we can do is say, well, why aren't we talking about the Black community? Why aren't we talking about the Asian community? Why aren't we talking about the Latin community? As an Asian man, you should be speaking about the Asian community. It should be specific to your community.
Yeah. Right? Yeah,
and, and as a Black woman, it should be specific to my community. And when we get together, it should be us.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes,
you
know? No, seriously. Yeah.
I said what I said.
Right. So you decided to end the film with Malcolm X's quote from 1965, "It's a time for martyrs now." I can't help but feel like this is this could be a rally cry for us in our current. Is that why you guys chose? Okay.
It was. Originally, that's not how the film was set to end. And, you know, so often in the editing room, you start to realize the film that you have put together, you know, if you're lucky enough to have an amazing editor, like I had Tarek Anwar, he was, as he was assembling the film, he was just picking the right shots and already had a very clear sense of, we need to stay in this wide shot. You know, it doesn't need to come here, or we don't need to go wide. And you start to dig in, and you're moving scenes around, and you're taking some scenes out because they're not moving the story along the way it needs to be moved along, or it's not driving the theme the way you thought it would have when you were shooting it. And what I truly discovered was there was this desire at the end for me to really put a stamp on the brotherhood thing that was happening in this film. And so where we originally, the film ends on Sam at the Johnny Carson. After he finishes his song, it was to roll into, I forgot which Sam Cooke song.
It's
on the tip of all of our tongues.
Well, I think we were good.
Change Gonna Come.
Yeah, no, it was, it ends with him finishing, you know, Change Is Gonna Come. And then we were going into, I think, Back to Good Times role for this coda that was gonna show pictures of our, because people really love that. When you do stories on actual people like to see the real picture of the person, or even the picture next to the actor, or with a little caption of what, you know, the outcome was. And I kind of felt like most people knew, and if they didn't, that's what the Google is for, and you no longer have to go to an encyclopedia or go ask, you know, a grandparent that was around at that time. you can easily Google. And I felt like I wanted to represent the brotherhood again. That was a really big theme in the film. And also, like you said, it was a rallying call, you know, to people like, you know, except for Jim, they're not here anymore, but we are here. Mm-hmm. So what within yourself feels, what does this move you to want to do? If most people who are familiar with Malcolm's story know in his time in the Nation to the time that he was no longer with the Nation, how much his views on humankind had changed. And there people who follow Sam's story knows how much Bob Dylan's song did get to him, and how he was very much aware that a change is going to come was different than anything that he had ever done, even though he had always been a writer that was writing from observation.
Right.
And their debate was so powerful throughout that if I had this thought, you know, what if instead of ending with him and Johnny Carson, I had this shot where we're in Malcolm and Betty's house where you see the TV, and we're gonna have to go pick up two scenes. So I thought, like, I can use another TV. How about we put him, Sam, inside the TV as if someone could be watching him? And then my editor took it a step further, and he was like, there's this shot of Malcolm. I'm just gonna put it together real quick and send you a quick time of it. And he sent it where Malcolm looks up and it looks like he's looking at Sam and like, all right, you heard me. And yeah. Sam bows, you know, I held the shot after Sam finished the song longer, where he kind of bows as if he's like, I hear you, brother. And so I was like, yes, that's it. And we'll end it. And we just need a powerful quote from Malcolm. And so I sent that over to Kemp, that ending. And Kemp was like, oh my God. Kemp and I like scoured through all of these Malcolm X books, Malcolm Speaks. Kemp is like a library of information on Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. And we found that quote and just felt like,
it's perfect.
It is. I think if anything, it does light a fire. It kind of brings you hope and kind of also. And also makes you kind of examine your own thoughts and like unpack your feelings, I guess.
And like you said, in a hopeful way. Mm-hmm. Not in a you better go do this way.
Right. Definitely.
Oh my goodness, you guys are running out of time.
I know. But you kind of answered a lot of our questions.
But I'm just enjoying talking to you. So before we move on to our last segment, Ms. King, what you've done so much with your career. Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you're just itching to do?
But Broadway
eventually. Okay, we're gonna do it. Get that EGOT. Get that EGOT.
It's not even for an EGOT. It's because it's something that I'd done plays when I was younger, and they were always in LA. I did like the Chitlin circuit, like a traveling, you know, play, and had gone to New Orleans, Miami, and Boston, a lot of different cities. And I love the feeling that you get immediately from the audience. And you know, you're really thriving off that energy from the audience. And, you know, if you go up on a line, there's no such thing as cut, you know, just figure it out. And then it's, that's me. All right, fine. Let me stay in it.
Would you want to do a play, musical, both?
I would want to do a play. And so what really sealed the deal for me is I love Broadway plays and musicals. Like that was my son and I from the time he was like 13 to maybe 19. Every year we would go to New York, like a mom and me trip. And we would just go see a week of plays and musicals and go to brand new restaurants. It's some of the best trips I've ever had. So I've always loved, and my son loves, you know, just the theater and like this
the kid, energy.
I used to watch Sound of Music over and West Side Story over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so I got an opportunity to present at the Tonys. So it was like, oh my God, I have died and gone to heaven. Yes. And so it was just so, so exciting. And I got to sit on the front row and I got to meet one of my most favorite actresses, Laura Linney, and present with her. And we got an opportunity to talk backstage. And I just asked her about the stage in Broadway. And she said, Regina, it's the most exhausting thing I've ever done. The most exhilarating thing I've ever done. And you have to do it. And it was one of those things where it was like, Laura Linney said, I have to do it.
I gotta do it.
Yes.
Double L has to say it.
Yeah, L squared told me I have to do it.
So. Well, we got a little taste of your stage play on SNL, so we can't wait to see you.
Weed gummy sketch.
Hilarious. That was the best.
I think just the whole energy of that episode was I love SNL, period.
I am just in awe of the writers and the actors and the band and the camera, the entire production. What they do every week to bring us that show every week is I had to sleep for like 24 hours and they're doing it every week. I'm just in awe.
I can't imagine how it is to be a cast member because I've just heard stories about their quick changes that they have to duck into a hallway and they just strip you.
Honey, yes. And like, you can't care if the curtain is like peeping out and your ass maybe out.
It doesn't matter. You feel like
make sure my wig is on right.
The gorilla wig. The gorilla wig. Yes.
Okay, so we like to end these interviews with the section we call the facts or the FAQs. Just really fun, funny questions. So the first question is, what is the last show that you binge watched?
The last show that I binge watched was Queen's Gambit.
Ooh, okay.
That was good. I like that.
Oh, that was good. Good.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? Actually, no. The last show that I binged was Bridgerton, Queen's Gambit. Okay. I wasn't expecting to like Bridgerton.
I haven't seen Bridgerton yet.
This is for like the kids. This is for like if I'm a 13-year-old white girl. Like, but Chris Van Dusen, he wrote the first episode that I directed on Scandal. So I'm a huge Shonda Rhimes fan. So I was like, I'm gonna tune in because that's my girl and that's my guy. And I was stuck.
I was so surprised. My mom was watching it when I was back home. I was like, Mom, my mom is not like it. But she actually liked it. I was like, okay, I guess.
Yeah, do not judge a book by cover. Do not say that this is for a 13-year-old white girl. What I said, you know, I'm owning this. I'm saying it out loud on the podcast. Shame on me. Because it was great. And oh, that queen baby. Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Those faces she would make.
Oh.
They were just priceless.
I mean, also, you know, I have to fit in RuPaul's Drag Race in every episode, and I just want to mention that you were a guest judge.
Yes,
and that's I just have to mention it.
He's part of the fantasy league, so he's.
I have a RuPaul's Drag Race fantasy league, and yeah. I'm like obsessed.
Okay, that sounds amazing.
You want to join?
I can't even imagine how that works. How are you choosing?
Yeah, you have to be like a connoisseur.
It is You know what? At the beginning of this season, I was like in second place. Now I'm in 11th. Got knocked because we pick three queens every week, and then based on their performance, we get points. I forgot to change my queens for this past week, and I lost. Well, yeah, I just lost. Anyway,
that's the reason I don't play fantasy football anymore, because I would forget to change my lineup, and I don't like to lose.
Yeah, I'm upset, but it's okay, guys. So you had a Zoom reunion for 227, right? Or did you have a Zoom? Well, anyways, just talk about 227. If there were to be a reunion episode or a revival, or you just like, you know, whatever, what do you envision the premise being like?
Oh my God. This is crazy. I don't know, but it is my hope that when I do another SNL, well, I get to host SNL again, that one of the skits would be Brenda and Calvin grown up and what 227 looks like. So I'm going to leave that to the SNL writers.
Oh my God, I would so love that.
I'm so excited Dino just got
my eyes.
His eyes above out. Okay, next question. If you asked your friends and family what your worst habit is, what would it be?
We're getting the dirt now.
Probably being too literal. You know, like if you say that you were gonna be on the corner by the red light at 2:22 and you are on the other corner at 2:25, I have a problem with that.
Oh, so you're very regimented.
I guess that could be annoying.
No, I was like being the only friend on time.
For people who aren't, like somebody like me who's always like 10 minutes late, I'm like, dang, I'm just 10 minutes late. Like,
yeah,
don't get me wrong. I am late.
Yeah.
But I always have a justification.
Yeah. what had happened was like, besides One Night in Miami, of course, what are some award season films that you personally are obsessed with or that you kind of watched and you were just like, ooh.
I love Judas and the Black Messiah.
Yes. Guess who's on our podcast tomorrow? We're having Dominique.
Oh, yes, love her.
It's so funny. I watch things now and I go, okay, I have to figure out how to work with that person. And she definitely, there is another film that she did when she was younger. I'm trying to think of the name of it.
Was it?
She's in foster care. And
yeah. It comes out of jail. It was a Sundance film. I can't remember. Yeah. I know it was Angie, the girl, the Shade Room. She wrote the.
Shade Room.
Angie's a person. She started the Shade Room.
I'm looking it up. I'm not sure. How long ago was it?
It was a couple years ago.
I mean, still totally recognize Dominique, but she is a bit younger.
I remember being told back then, like, you need to watch this Dominique girl. Like, you're gonna see her. And I've been just so enamored by her performances.
So she's can great. You tell her for me?
Yes.
She is simply awesome. I cannot wait to meet her one day. And I cannot wait to work with her.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Look at us connecting people.
Look at you.
Yes. I love it. Love to see it. Okay. Would you rather be an amazing painter or a brilliant mathematician?
Painter.
I think I'd be a painter. Yeah.
I would be.
As long as you know like basic math in life, like
anything. You don't need to know no one's quadratic formula.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure out where in life I'm applying algebra to.
Right. Or geometry. Oh,
basic subtraction and addition with the occasional division and multiplication is all you need.
Yeah, exactly.
And our final question is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's an actor, creator, producer, writer, that is not in the mainstream or doesn't have much shine that you wanna kind of shout out and give more recognition to?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm sure there are. I wish you had asked me before this. because the first thing that came to my mind, and she is in the industry and she is getting recognized, is Michaela Coel.
We agree on that.
She deserves more.
Oh my gosh.
Ever since I saw her on Chewing Gum and even like before that, I was just like, why aren't we talking about her?
About her, yeah.
I may destroy you like they destroyed me. Like
it did.
And just like, her ability to tell such a painful story and add humor.
Mm-hmm.
To it, but it's still at its core, you know,
still feel it, the pain,
be heartbreaking.
Yeah,
like for her to handle that much tone and kind of contain it,
yeah,
that is brilliant. Like seriously, I know that word brilliant gets thrown around, but like how could you laugh at what's happening on that screen in that show and then cry the next moment it's so good.
Shout out to Michaela. Definitely
deserves
more. Yes. Regina, thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you too. This was fun.
I'm glad.
I hope so.
Yeah, great. We're so grateful and best of luck to you. Congrats
on everything, for real.
You and everything. We can't wait to see what else you have.
Yeah, and we can't wait to see you in person one day.
Best of luck to the both of you. And I am claiming that the next time I see you, I will be able to say what color your eyes are.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Regina.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.